Well, now we're going to go all around the planet with Albert Taylor with our paranormal experiences. So get ready for that. And welcome to Coast to Coast. It's been about 4 years since Albert Taylor was on with me. He comes from a structured military and engineering background. He is the last person anyone would expect to have a very long history of OBEs, out-of-body experiences. He was a crew chief for the Ultra Secret U-2 planes earlier in his career, was part of the stealth program, and was also one of the engineers responsible for some of the designs of the U.S. Space Station. Here he is, back on Coast to Coast, author of Soul Traveler, Albert Taylor. Albert, how are you?
I'm doing great, George. It's such a pleasure to be back with you.
Good to have you back as well. What have you been up to over the past 4 years?
Absolutely nothing. Just sitting around the house, twiddling my thumbs. No. Now, I've been really blessed. I didn't plan it. I was invited to lecture for a wonderful weekend in London, which overwhelming to get there and have that many people waiting to hear what I had to say. Here it is, all 15 years after the first publication of Soul Traveler. People still think it's interesting. And also, all my life, I have been drawn to Egypt, and I couldn't understand why. I wear a scarab ring. I wear a cartouche. My cat is the name of my cat is Scarab. So that tells you I've been drawn to Egypt for the longest, as long as I can remember. And like I was telling Lisa, it was something that was on my bucket list. That I just had to do. So I got back from Egypt right before, as a matter of fact, everything seemed to go topsy-turvy and the revolution happened, and I got out of there in December.
Well, you know, lots have been going on. Zahi's now back in power after he was out. The guy is like the Teflon man.
A lot has happened, you know. And just before, when I was there in Cairo, and there's a lot going on there. There was an election that occurred when I was there, and I guess some people were happy about it, some people were not happy about it. And then they had other inner struggles going on regarding the Muslim population, which is, you know, is the dominant population. And then I believe what they call the Coptics, which is more like the Christians. And, George, I've never seen anything like this. If anybody goes to Egypt or has been, it's very different from being here at home. I think the last time I saw someone actually carrying casually an automatic weapon was when I was in the military. But everywhere you go. And
that's
even
changed.
It's just unreal. It's a little unnerving at first when you get there. When I visited the church, the Coptic church, which is kind of is a Christian church, basically, that you approach it, it looks more like a miniature compound because outside of the entranceway, which it only had one, was two gentlemen sitting there in chairs with, I think, AK-47s or something, automatic weapons. That I'd never seen anything like that in my life. And as a matter of fact, I got a chance to go to Upper and Lower Egypt and visit some Nubian villages and different things like that. But everywhere I went, I had to be escorted by a security man with an automatic weapon. It was just very, very different from any place I'd ever been.
Was it a mystical experience for you out there, Albert?
Well, definitely. I don't see how you could go and see these amazing things that I'd always seen in documentaries and books and things like that, and to actually set foot there and be embraced, which really surprised me too, George, is that I was really embraced by the people in Egypt, especially in the Nubian, Upper Egypt, but the way they treated me, and I was with 15 other people, and they said that the way they treated me, even the people that I was with said, "What's going on, Al? They're treating you like a rock star," and I was kind of shocked about that because I didn't know anybody, and they didn't really know who I was or anything like that. But I was just embraced, which was they kept calling me cousin and hugging me, and everywhere I went, and it was amazing. And even I was on a boat going down the Nile. We were headed toward the botanical gardens, And I pointed to the steering mechanism, just smiling, pointing to the steering mechanism of the gentleman who was piloting the boat. And he got up out of his chair and moved over and pointed to the chair. And I moved up and moved over to the seat and got a chance to pilot the boat down the Nile, which no one else was given that opportunity, which I was really, really surprised. And it was such an amazing experience. I can't even begin to tell you. It definitely was life-changing.
If you can imagine, Albert, what it was like 2,000, 3,000 years ago in that area, and there you were. Isn't that incredible?
The first thing that comes to mind, George, is it probably was extremely hot. Because I'll tell you, oh, my God. 120-degree weather, approximately, when I was there. And they told me it had just cooled off. I got there at the right time because it had just cooled off, which I could not believe. But going through the I got a chance to go to the Valley of Kings, which, you know, everybody knows that that's where Tutankhamun was discovered, mm-hmm. the tomb of Tutankhamun, and numerous other tombs, Ramses III, I believe, and I get mixed up with the numbers, but just going there and imagining these people slaving under this heat in this area to discover something and day in and day out, not knowing if it was there or not, it just was overwhelming just to think about and try to visualize that happening so many years ago was an amazing, amazing experience. I was also blessed enough that I got a chance to go into several tombs and deep down into them and see the different hieroglyphics and paintings that were inside the walls. Just to think that those things were, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 years old, and here there were people in here carving these exquisite drawings carvings and painting these amazing drawings, because everything regarding the tombs is covered in some type of story or message or cartouche or something, and everything fits so perfectly together. It was really, truly overwhelming and beautiful.
Amazing. Albert, did you have a chance to visit the Sphinx, and what do you think about the possibilities that the Hall of Records is at the foot of the Sphinx?
Yeah, I definitely did, and I've taken some amazing pictures just at that location. I did think about the possible chambers underneath. I'm talking to the people. You know, I tried to talk to the various people and the guide that was with us, who was also an Egyptologist, which was really, I was really blessed with that because she was a wealth of information, and talked about possibly there being an area, undiscovered area under the tomb. And the Egyptians themselves don't believe that there is. The woman that I was, that was my guide, the Egyptologist, she had studied under, I can't, correct me if I get the gentleman's, the doctor's name wrong,
Zahi Hawass.
Zahi Hawass. She had studied under him. And so she was very knowledgeable, and I'm glad to say a lot friendlier than he probably would be. But they didn't support any kind of things like UFOs building the pyramids. They thought that was absolutely ridiculous. They felt it was their ancestors who slaved and not slaved, but actually constructed all the pyramids in that area and the Sphinx. Even though the Sphinx is very, very old and amazing to see, but they themselves, the people there, do not believe that there's any hidden passages or chambers of any sort below the Sphinx.
Now, Albert, let me ask you about your trip to London, and what did you do there?
London was, you know, I wrote in my book years ago, back in 1996, I think, I finished it and got published. I wrote in there about two out-of-body experiences that I had to Stonehenge. So seeing Stonehenge, first of all, in the distance, when I was on the bus, in the distance to see Stonehenge with my own eyes, I'll tell you, George, I had to do everything I could to keep from tearing up because it was the most amazing and most magnificent thing I'd ever seen. I was so emotional. And the first thing when I got out to walk up to one of the entryways and start approaching Stonehenge, is the first thing I remembered, it was my flights, my out-of-body experience flights over there. And everything looked so familiar. It was like it was like my third visit. Physically, it felt like just the surroundings, the burial mounds that surround the area. It's out in the middle of nowhere, by the way. It's about 2 hours ride from London.
Right.
And it's out in the middle of nowhere. But the first thing I noticed was I could close my eyes just right now and remember my two flights. They were so, my out-of-body flights, I should say. They were so vivid, I can remember them in a lot of detail. And the one thing that struck me was during my out-of-body experience there is that there were more lintels, horizontal pieces of stone setting on top. That the top portion is called a lintel, and there were more lintels in my out-of-body experience than there is today. So the only thing I could think of, because at the time I didn't think about it, but it makes a lot of sense. So the only thing I could think of is that when I had my two experiences there, they were not in this particular time frame. They had to have been a lot earlier, and that illuminates the information that was shared with me when I went there, because obviously it was something that was timeless and very old, and the experience was something that involving the history of the Druids and Stonehenge. So that was really overwhelming, because I didn't think about the time change. I really just think about the actual travel there and visual experience. But seeing it and realizing that the lintels were there when I flew over, it tells me that it wasn't in current day. It was amazing. Truly.
Did you build a robot out there?
My ghost bot. No, I did build a robot, and I'll tell you how that came about. I think that I call it GB3000 right now, or GB3.0. I didn't nickname it ghost bot, but everybody else calls it that. I was invited to, my group was invited to investigate a home, a 100-year-old home in Rialto, California. And we were invited by the realtor who was trying to sell the home, which is very rare, because I'd never been invited by a realtor before. And the reason that she invited us is she said that she has a gentleman that cleans the house for her on a regular basis. He cleans all her homes prior to the sale or to touring around with the potential buyers. And she said something happened to him that scared him so bad in the house that he ran out of the house and left all his cleaning equipment and refuses to go back to the house. So she called us, she heard about us, and she called us to go out there and to see what's going on. So needless to say, I was really excited about going to the house. We got there a little after midnight, set up all of our equipment, and this was an amazing house. There's absolutely all the power was cut off to the home.
And where specifically was the house?
This is Rialto, California.
Okay.
Right. Fairly old area. It's a 100-year-old home, and I say some of the other houses are very amazing. They're like look like river rock or something like that. The construction of the house almost like a little castle. Beautiful old place. We set up equipment in this place, and one of the things we did is we did a sweep, an EMF sweep. And basically, I was looking for any type of electromagnetic field energy that would spike in the house, especially since there should be almost zero because the power was shut off to the house. So immediately what we did, we found out is we picked up an EMF reading that was in the center of this room. And what was really interesting about the EMF reading is that it didn't reach to the ceiling and it didn't touch the floor. It was kind of in the middle of the room, and it began, and it was a roving EMF field. So it began to move around, which we know, wires and things like that, and wiring and chandeliers, even if the power was on, it would not move. We wouldn't get something that's moving from one location to another. So that was the first thing that we detected. We set up a static camera pointing in the direction that we were walking so that we could observe ourselves. And we walked up the stairs to the top portion of the house. And we were, while moving around and investigating the house, we actually found the classic passageway behind the bookshelf, which was amazing. So we slid open the bookshelf, and there literally was a passageway back there. It was fairly small. If you had to enter it, I think you'd have to go on your hands and knees. And the one thing struck me is, it looked like no one had been in the passage for at least 80 to 90 years, and it was undisturbed. It was a layer of dust.
Bet it was creepy, Albert, wasn't it?
I think there's something wrong with me, George, because when I go to these places, I don't get creeped out. I'm so curious.
Really?
I'm the guy that the monster in the movies, that he's coming toward the guy with the camera, and the guy keeps holding the camera, and eventually the camera drops to the ground and is photographing.
And you get eaten. You're the one who gets eaten all the time.
I'm the guy that gets eaten or attacked because so busy filming the footage that I'm too, not reactive enough to take off and run for my life. I guess for the average person, which I've had a lot of people join my group and a lot of people leave it because some people just can't handle it. For the average person, I'd say, yeah, definitely it was a little creepy, especially with the roving EMS seals. But there was something else that occurred downstairs while we were filming upstairs that happened that we found later that really shocked us. But anyway, let me tell you real quick. So I'm looking in the passageway, and I stopped my crew from going in there because I didn't want to disturb the environment because it was, a 90-year-old pristine environment. And that's when I had the idea that if I had some kind of probe or a droid or a robot or something, kind of like the explorers on Mars, if I had something that could move into that area, it would disturb a little bit, but not as much as a person in overalls and equipment scurrying down the passageway. And that's when I came up with the idea. And I went home after gathering all our equipment at the investigation. And my house, I wouldn't say it's out of sorts and messy, but I do collect electronic stuff and radio control and motors. And because I'm always thinking there's going to be some use to this kind of stuff eventually.
You probably have boxes of stuff,
I have literally boxes and boxes of things that I guess the average person would throw out, but each one of them means something. And even though it's very cluttered in my hobby room, I know where everything is in the box. So I start putting parts and things like that together. I'd already studied C++ programming years ago when I was on the space station program with a friend of mine working on some projects there. So I was familiar with programming, and I constructed this bot and gave it a really nice microprocessor that I could actually plug up to my computer and program. And that was the beginning of GhostBot 1.0. And to this day, that thing is an amazing tool and device to use on paranormal investigation. I don't know if anybody else uses a robot, but it has added to what we do tremendously. But let me tell you now.
Well, let's hold on. We're coming up to the break here, Albert. And also, I want to talk with you about the astral plane. You've been there quite a bit, and I want to get your take on just what's out there. Albert's website, alberttaylor.com. We'll be right back. Don't touch your dial. With our special guest tonight, Albert Taylor, author of Soul Traveler, A Guide to Out-of-Body Experiences and the Wonders Beyond. And we're going to get into that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Albert, lots of people are brand new to the program. They probably don't even know what an out-of-body experience is. Can you explain that for us? And then we'll get into this astral plane in just a second. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, it would be my pleasure. basically, it happens in a lot of ways. There's several kinds or out-of-body experiences. One that people may be familiar with is the near-death experience. Believe it or not, that is an out-of-body experience. And as people are very familiar with, it usually happens because of a trauma to the body, or maybe some surgery or something like that, and a person finds themselves floating above their body. They may even visit relatives, hear doctors talking about them, or see some things that would be impossible to see if you were in your physically there. Like, I know of one story that happened in Seattle where a woman, during surgery, she died and found herself floating outside of the hospital and saw a tennis shoe on the ledge of the hospital. Later on, a nurse friend of mine got a chance to climb out onto that ledge, and you couldn't see the tennis shoe from the window, but it was definitely out there and obstructed from view, and they found the tennis shoe. So that's one type of out-of-body experience. The other one is the spontaneous nightly out-of-body experience, and that's what happens to me. And it's been happening to me since I was approximately 5 years old. A lot of people may relate to it. It usually starts with maybe you'll wake up in the middle of the night and you'll feel paralyzed, unable to move. You may hear sounds. You may hear buzzing. You may feel someone touch you. You may see images moving around the room. It could be kind of scary because if you don't know what it is, it's very, very real. And then you may find yourself floating above your body. You may feel a vibration as you leave your body. And then the next thing, usually, especially what happened to me, is I wear glasses. And all of a sudden, I could see. And I could see, not only could I just see, I could see the room very clearly. Mm-hmm. And I was a little puzzled by that because I normally wear glasses, and I should not, the room should have been blurry. I'm not blind, but I usually use glasses for distance. So I noticed that I was peering around the room with a different type of vision. I found out that I was able to walk on the floor if I chose to. I could float around the room if I chose to. And this was the most wonderful part about it, I think everybody is excited about, is you can actually fly.
You teach yourself this?
No, it happened to me when I was young. And one of the things I would tell my mother is I would say, Mom, I wake up in my dreams. And I couldn't, that was as much as I could explain to her as a six-year-old and seven-year-old. And no one understood me. And it wasn't until years later, maybe 30 years later, three decades, that I started reading up on, I believe it was in an Omni magazine, I started reading up on people who have lucid dreams. And that was the first time I'd ever heard anybody put a label to the experiences that I was having. So I didn't teach myself how to do it. I really taught myself what was happening to me normally. And it would happen when I was young about once a week. And then about age 30, about three decades later, it began happening several times a week and then sometimes three times a night. And then that's when it got my attention. And I began to keep a journal that eventually turned into my book, Soul Traveler.
That's incredible. Albert, this happened to me when I was 11 years old. I can't duplicate it. And I've had guests like you on and some others who've come on to try to help me. But I think I've gotten close, very, very close. But just
George, you've never asked me to help you.
No, sir, not yet. That's right.
I helped Art. Art had an out-of-body experience. He called me from France. And had an out-of-body experience in France. In France, he called me from France and told to tell me he had an out-of-body experience.
Good old Art.
And I've had people who've never had out-of-body experiences. And like a woman was 40 years old, took my weekend workshop. And about maybe a year later or so, she had an incredible out-of-body experience. Sometimes it happens sooner, sometimes it happens later, but there's so many different techniques to use because not every technique works with everyone. So I recommend highly that you try as many techniques as possible, and if something doesn't work for you, discard it and move on to the next one because there's a high probability, maybe about 80%, that you're going to be able to have a spontaneously, consciously controlled out-of-body experience.
One of the fears of this, Albert, that you can't get back into your physical body.
Right.
What do you say about that?
Well, that fear usually comes from people who haven't had the experience. I can say this. The only time I've ever had difficulty reconnecting with my body was only because I didn't know how. It wasn't like I couldn't get in. I just didn't know how to reconnect. Now, if I would have been in this state for an extended period of time, let's say, the longest I've ever been able to stay out of my body is about 2 to 3 hours. And then something odd happens. It's like an automatic recall, and your body literally starts pulling on you no matter where you are. You become more and more aware of the physical body, and eventually you can't stay out, and you're drawn back in. Now, in the short term, when you're just leaving briefly and coming back and wanting to reconnect with your body, one of the mistakes I made was trying to move my entire body. So I felt paralyzed still and felt like I couldn't reconnect with my physical body. But one of the things I discovered is just try to move a small portion of your body, like the little finger or toe or even your tongue, and that will help you reconnect with the physical body. So there's no need to worry about not being able to reconnect with your body. It's just sometimes you do have a process or something happens that you'll need to use a technique to reconnect.
What is on the astral plane, Albert?
Now, see, in the astral plane is an amazing place. Imagine a picture, a clear picture of that you would hold water in. And I fill that picture up halfway with dirt. Well, that dirt represents the physical plane, everything that's here on Earth. Now, imagine I take another picture of that's clear water, and that water represents the astral plane. So when I pour that water into the beaker, it starts interacting with the dirt. So at the lower levels of that pitcher of water and the dirt, it's very dry. And when you go up to higher, you go up, the water starts interacting with it and becomes wet. So, and then as you go further up, it gets turbid and eventually it gets very clear. Mm-hmm. Well, that's how the astral plane interacts with our physical world here. Part of it is definitely here in my room and in your studio where you are, and even further than that, even out in space, as far as you can even think of. And then part of it, as the vibrational level of the astral plane increases, part of it is not here. So there may be on the other side, at a little higher level, that's where you have spirits, deceased persons, where that's where we paranormalists see ghosts and things like that, at that lower level of the astral plane that interacts with the physical plane. But it goes beyond, far, far beyond that. And you think about this. Someone who named it, because it's a metaphysical term, astral, which means the stars. Someone had an experience, an out-of-body experience, years and years and maybe thousands of years ago. And they were in maybe a hut or a cave or something very, very primitive and simple. And they had the wherewithal to name this area that they were witnessing astral, which means of the stars. Why would a person name something like that of the stars when they're just having the experience in their room or close to their physical body? So that right there is a key as to what really the astral plane is all about.
Are there different levels where the bottom is a place you just don't want to go, and the higher up you go, the closer you get to this heavenly type state?
Well, that's a great question, because definitely at the lower levels of the astral plane, you know, let me explain this. Each and every one of us vibrates at a certain level. Now, as you increase your spiritual awareness and learning and behavior and things like that, it changes you internally. It changes the vibration of your consciousness, your soul consciousness, I like to call it. Okay, the astral plane has many levels of vibration, and even there's some places that go beyond the astral plane that are even higher vibration. So at the lower levels, you, if you're, let's say your soul is maybe vibrating at a 3. Well, then when you go into the astral plane, you're going to have access to everything from level 1 to level 3, but you won't be able to go to level 4 because your particular soul vibration hasn't achieved that level yet. So that's kind of how the astral plane is. At the very low levels, you're going to have very low vibrational souls, and it may be people who have obsessions, addictions. And anger issues and all kinds of things like that. They're going to be at the very low levels. So if you enter the astral plane, especially right coming straight out of the body, there's a good chance you're going to encounter those type of vibrational spirits that vibrate at that level. But there are many, many other levels, and as you start ascending upward, then you start running into the more angelic-like encounters and things that are going to definitely be life-altering and spirit going to help your spirit to evolve at a higher rate.
Some people, as they go through the astral plane, will witness some of this. Will you physically be able to see it, these other planes?
It's not about see as much as perception.
Perception.
Because you got to think about this. You don't have a retina, and you don't have a lens in your eye focusing light onto that retina. It's not like that. So you definitely can feel a vibration when you transition from one plane to another, meaning the astral plane does have a ceiling, and the astral body is a vehicle to maneuver around the astral plane. But that's why they call it astral body, because it's limited to the astral plane. You can actually, the soul consciousness can actually leave the astral body and achieve higher evolutionary experiences. So there definitely is a level. You can think of it as floors 1 through 10, but then there's more executive floors, 10 through 20.
What about the cord that connects the physical body with the astral body? It's incredible elasticity. It's
the silver cord.
Yeah, you can just go forever and it won't break. But if it is severed, some say you die. Have you seen the cord?
And I've read that extensively. I've read books on it. I know about other people having experiences with the silver cord. I've been out of my body so many times and leaving the astral body. The silver cord would be attached from the physical body to the astral body usually. But in my particular case, I have no connection like that. So I can't say that if it was disconnected, I would die, because I'm still here. I think of the silver cord, and it may exist for some people, because there are some things that are created by our consciousness that is designed to assist us, to help us with fear and things that like that that we're experiencing on the other side. Because you're not alone, you do have some kind of assistance. So I think of the silver cord is more like breadcrumbs. That way you kind of have, if you get out a long distance away, you kind of have this idea that you won't get lost. You could at least follow the silver cord back to your physical body. But me personally, I haven't had any experiences with it.
Albert, when you sleep, does the astral body hover over the physical body while you're sleeping?
No, usually the astral body is around the physical body. The astral body surrounds the soul consciousness. When the soul consciousness detaches from the physical body, the astral body will go with it to wherever you're going to go. Just like if there's a ghost or somebody dies, generally, especially like a near-death experience too, the astral body and the soul consciousness are one and can leave the physical body. And that's when we paranormalists are able to pick up an energy spike, like an EMF spike, that's generated from the soul consciousness and the astral body connection. Because when they're connected, there's an energy, there's a magnetic field around them. When the soul consciousness leaves the astral body, then the astral body stays on the physical plane. And usually it begins, especially if this is a permanent, if the person has died. And because of reincarnational reasons, it's really complex, that the astral body is no longer going to be used, that it slowly degrades into the astral substance that's around us at the lower at the astral plane.
Have you seen astral animals at all? You know, the astral body of an animal?
You know, and I wondered about that, and I had, the answer is yes. And the way it happened is my dog had to be put to sleep maybe 15 years ago or longer. And I really love that dog. And while I was laying on the couch one night, I found myself paralyzed, and I began to think about what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go astrally. And as I began to float upward out of the body to prepare to go do something, all of a sudden I felt this hairy animal on me. And it was laying on me and rubbing up against me and things like that. And everybody who's a pet owner, they may be able to relate to this.
We've had that experience, absolutely.
Yeah, I know my pet's fur. I know when I touch him, what it feels like. I can be blind and I could recognize him. And that's when I realized, oh my God, my dog is on the astral plane. He actually does exist. So I don't know if every living thing down to an insect has an astral image or astral doppelganger. I don't know, but definitely our pets, like dogs, maybe cats. I haven't had experience with a cat yet, and I'm a cat lover too. Maybe cats and dogs and other animals do have some type of astral image or astral projection.
$64,000 question here, Albert. Not that I'm going to give it to you if you're right. Heaven and hell in the astral plane, yes or no?
Wow. Now, you know this, George. That's a belief system.
Yes.
A lot of people I've talked to, people who had near-death experiences and have come back and talked about having visited hell. But you know what's interesting about that? First of all, let me tell you, in all of my travels, I have not seen what you would classify to be hell or Hades or an inferno or a place where people are being tortured.
Nothing. Or evil.
I haven't had any experience whatsoever.
Demons now, grabbing you, anything like that?
I've had situations where I felt like I was being grabbed, and I even saw what you would call an evil image. But I found out that was early on in my experiences, years and years ago, where I found out I was actually creating these images out of astral substance. Now, that's what's interesting about the astral plane, George, is that it's not just like a gas. You know, like you're in a cloudy kind of atmosphere. The astral plane is interactive. So it responds at a micro level to our consciousness.
Well, and you know what? Since you brought that up, too, we're going to talk about dark matter with you. But I do want to talk more about demons, Albert, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Albert's website, alberttaylor.com. We'll be back.